scarcely noticed the sights above. The glowed all orange with lights of green. From where on earth came this strange machine? No, no, no UFO. The thing swooped down from outer space.
Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Denny Libby from Dudley and the Do-Rights. Today is February 5th, 2010, and I'm talking with Denny Libby. Denny, can you give me your full name, your birth date, and your hometown, please?
Yes, I can. Be happy to do that. It's Dennis L. Libby, and I was born February 26, 1947, at Swedish Hospital in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
What part of town did you grow up in?
I grew up in Robbinsdale, where my family homestead, I think, started in 1926.
What was your first introduction to the local music scene?
I actually had an opportunity when I was hanging out with some of the theater guys as a freshman in high school to go down to a place called the Scholar in the old dinky downtown, and there were lots of folk players, and actually had a chance one night to walk in and eat a bunch of peanuts and listen to a guy by the name of Bob Dylan playing.
Seriously?
And, you know, I'll never forget that. And, of course, these theater guys, the theater majors that were 2 and 3 years older than me, were always dragging me in the back room where there were chess games and all that kind of stuff. And there'd always be somebody back there playing Delta Blues or folk kind of stuff. But I listened to a lot of early harmonica music, which is kind of odd, I guess, but I liked it, and ended up having some. My parents bought me a Chromatic 64 harmonica, and I used to play a lot of the stuff off the Johnny Puleo and the Harmonica Rascals and the Mulcahys, which actually were on Soma Records real early. So my first music was really not rock and roll, but a lot of radio. My dad was an interesting guy who used to import stuff from Japan, and one of the first things that he imported were real small transistor radios. I was the only kid on the bus as a freshman in high school that had a headphone and a radio and could listen to some of the early rock and roll and rockabilly, and you know, this is late 50s.
What stations were you able to pick up?
I think everything was all AM then. I remember,
WDGY and
WDGY and KDWB. Those were the first two stations, which I ended up listening to for a long time after that.
So you were listening right at the transition there into the 1960s.
Yep. Yeah, my dad had a wire recorder, preceded tape recorders, and I used to record things like Wolverton Mountain, and loved to sing along with that stuff. And then, of course, wasn't too much longer after that. We had the bands like the Four Seasons, you know, interesting, different kind of singers, and I used to try to emulate Frankie Valli. I'd come home from high school, and I'd sneak this record player out, put it on the kitchen table, and practice with Four Seasons records, and then have to hurry and scurry and put it away before my mother came home from work from the hospital, because she thought that when I sang that music, I sounded like a baby with colic. They didn't care for the music very much.
Do you remember the first record you bought?
I actually do remember the first record that I bought. And I bought it from a little small independent record store. What the heck was it? The Lou... Oh, I wish I could remember that, but it was a 45. It was a 45 of an Everly Brothers song. And I'm was real, real early Everly Brothers. Can't remember the name of the song. That was one of the first.
So was that a small record store somewhere?
Don Leary Records. I just remembered what it was. Yeah, small little record store.
In North Minneapolis?
Yeah, North Minneapolis. And later on, he had a store out in New Hope.
So now we're getting into the rock and roll era. Do you remember the first local rock and roll band you saw play live?
Yeah, the first rock and roll band I heard live was... the Underbeats.
Where did you see them?
I saw them at a place called, it was above a bank over in Camden. I can't remember the name of the hall, but it was called the Camden Bank. And I remember going over there with a couple of other friends of mine from high school. And I remember walking up this stairway to get up to the upper level ballroom. And on the way up there, there were some kind of tough gang type guys in the hallway. And I don't know what it was they didn't like about me, but I remember one of the guys picking me up by the back of the sweater and my belt and hanging me out the window for about 25 seconds. And was on to listen to the Underbeats. And
what'd you think of the Underbeats?
We thought they were fabulous. I mean, they were great, and they had a look. You know, they had the berets and all the latest cool guitars, and they played a lot of neat older songs.
What was the first band you were involved with?
The first band that I was involved with was a band called the Treble Men. And it was interesting because it was a friend of mine from school in Robbinsdale. His dad owned the drugstore in downtown Robbinsdale, and he had a Fender Jazzmaster guitar and liked almost exclusively all surf songs. And approached me one day and asked me if I would be interested in coming to their rehearsal and if I knew how to do Surfin' Bird.
Do you know?
By the Trashmen.
What was the name? What was the name of your friend?
His name was Bob Cohen, and it was interesting because he was a good friend of mine. We hung out together. His family was Jewish. My family were, you know, a bunch of Lutheran suburban guys' family, and he dragged me to St. Louis Park to where all of his friends were, and I was the only Gentile in the band. So we had a Jewish drummer, two Jewish guitar players, and a Gentile lead singer. And the band was called the Treblemen because we didn't have a bass player. And so my claim to fame was that I could sing Surfin' Bird. And for a while, that's the only song I sang. So the band jobs that we played and the little parties that we played were usually for bar mitzvahs or, you know, these gigs that these guys are playing. And then there was the novelty act of me coming up and singing Surfin' Bird. The rest of the songs were all things by the Astronauts and the Ventures with no vocals. So then we kind of expanded in doing a few more vocal songs.
So Surfin' Bird is out. This puts us around 1963 or later.
Yeah, it would have been about 1963, a little bit later than that. And the Trashmen were big then, and they were from that area. They were from the Robbinsdale area, so we knew those guys. And I used to go out and see them and hang out and hear them play quite often.
What were some of the hot spots in town to see bands play live at?
Mr. Lucky's, for sure. And I had a high school buddy that we would do a circuit every weekend, never do any homework. You know, we'd always just get in his 1957 Oldsmobile, which was one of these sleeper cars with the big giant engine, two doors, no trim, and three speeds on the tree, which was great for us because we'd always go down to Mr. Lucky's first and hear whoever was there, Accents, Underbeats, Avantis, and so on. And then we'd drive out to Danceland at Excelsior in the same night and hit both those spots. That was a common weekend for listening to music.
Who was your friend?
His name was Joe Roots. Wild and crazy Joe Roots.
What do you recall about Danceland?
Well, it was such an interesting and strange environment because you had the amusement park across the street. And, you know, you always kind of had to hang out there and check girls out. And then you ended up going out to the ballroom where Big Reggie Callahan was always at the front door with the W.C. Fields nose and checking everybody to making sure they were old enough to get in. And then the bizarre experience of having the Underbeats play there and do their foot stomp and hit and actually feel the floor in the ballroom move up and down with the weight of the people stomping their feet on the floor.
So where did you go next in your musical career?
The Treblemen actually decided that they wanted to have a bass player. And I didn't play bass. I didn't play anything at all other than a little harmonica, and that didn't fit in much with a surf band at the time. So I got canned, and what happened is they let me go for a singing bass player who many years later ended up being a good friend of mine and ended up playing with the High Spirits, a guy by the name of Rick Beresford. And so he ended up being their bass player, and dejected and really anxious to still play, ran into a couple other high school buddies, mainly a drummer by the name of Dan Munson. And he knew I could sing, knew I could do Surfing Bird and a bunch of other stuff, but at the time I didn't play at all. And so he wanted to know if I wanted to join the band. And I went out to a rehearsal with Dan Munson, who ended up playing with the Fabulous Flippers for many, many years. Tom Husting, the guitar player that I played with later on in the Castaways. Dave Hobson. Tom Husting was playing through a Silvertone guitar that the amplifier was built into the guitar case. So this was pretty primitive early rock and roll stuff. At first I just came and sang, and then they thought I had played a little piano. I'd had some piano lessons. So I ended up managing to borrow some money from a friend, and I bought an old beat up wooden Wurlitzer piano, kind of like the Ray Charles style. Learned some chords and banged out a few chords and played a few old rock and roll songs, some Chuck Berry stuff, because that's what the guitar players wanted to play. And that band actually became Dudley and the Do-Rights. We added another second guitar player, so we had two guitars, and we needed it because my piano playing wasn't really all that strong. But then what happened is that band really evolved into much more of a blues band. And I got my interest in doing Old Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. And that's about the same time that we discovered the Accents, who did all that same kind of material and did such an amazing job playing all that stuff. And then the old Lonnie Mack stuff. And that was about the same time I played a little place called the Reef Club with Dudley and the Do-Rights.
Where was that?
It was down on West Broadway and Penn Avenue. And it was funny how I got involved in it, because the neighbor that lived behind me about two houses owned this place, and they wanted to do something with it that was constructive other than just have an empty storefront. And the neighbor approached me one day and said, you're in this band thing, this music thing. What would you think if we put a place together where musicians could play and young kids could come and stay out of trouble and listen to music? And I said, wow, that'd be a wonderful thing. And do you think we could play? And they said, sure, we'd love to have you come and play. So we did a couple gigs there, and they said, well, what other bands could we get? What other bands do the kids like? And I said, oh, boy, if you could get, like, the Castaways. And this is, of course, before Liar Liar was a big hit, but the band was popular. And so they said, fine, let us know how to get a hold of them. And so one of the first bands that came and played the Reef Club was Dudley and the Do-Rights, and then one of the first named bands was the Castaways. And that's where I met Jim Donna, met the guys in the Castaways, and ended up taking rock and roll piano lessons from Jim Donna. The first real rock and roll songs that I learned how to play, like What I Say and some of the R&B songs that I learned taking lessons at Jim Donna's house over in Northeast Minneapolis.
Just for the record here, who played what in Dudley and the Do-Rights?
I played keyboard and sang, and Randy Anderson, who was Dudley, played actually at the time kind of rhythm guitar, and the lead guitarist was a guy by the name of Tom Husting, who got a nickname later on of Footy, and Dave Hobson played bass, and Dan Munson on drums.
You're still in high school at this point?
Yeah, we were all in high school. I was a junior becoming a senior, and they were all a year behind me.
So how did your 45 come out?
Well, my relationship with Jim Donna ended up growing as time went by, and we started emulating more of the Castaways song list and a lot of the rock and roll, and admired those guys for their musical proficiency and how tight and great they sounded as a band. And as it turned out, the Castaways got so popular they couldn't play all the gigs that they had. And so Jim Donna, who was pretty active as a booking agent and a manager, became our booking agent. And it was great for us because we played a lot of these really nice places that the Castaways played but couldn't fill the bill. So we ended up getting those jobs. And it was a very good band, the Dudley and the Do-Rights, good players. I mean, we were kind of a garage band by virtue of the fact that that's where we practiced. I think it was later on that garage band meant bands of minimal proficiency and musical talent, but that was a very talented young band that did a nice job, and we got hired back after we played some of these Castaways job once. We actually got hired back by the ballroom owners, and so Jim Donna and that relationship kind of grew into him being our booking agent.
Who came up with the name Dudley and the Do-Rights?
I did.
This was based on the cartoon?
The cartoon character. I just changed the spelling a little bit. And you know, I was kind of the commercial hokey guy in the band. Everybody else was real serious about playing the blues and being a real serious blues band. And I just plain wanted to play. So I learned a lot about the more the commercialism and promoting the band. And a goofy name like that was something that people could remember.
Can you name a couple songs Dudley and the Do-Rights played live?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the sensational things that we did is when one of our, our guitar player, Footy, sister brought an album from Chicago that had not been released or played by anybody around here at all, and it was the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And so we learned a whole bunch of tunes from the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and I'm sorry, I can't remember some of the names of some of those tunes, but we played a kind of a battle of the bands at the University Armory with the Underbeats, the Castaways, I think the Del Counts, and we played all this Paul Butterfield Blues Band music, which nobody ever heard before, and we did it really well. And it kind of made a name for ourselves. But we still did a lot of the old Castaways tune list. We would do Turn on Your Love Light, you know, kind of a big crowd pleaser. And we would do things like On Broadway, you know, things that were some vocals. We very early on did a couple of Beatles songs, but they were not the ones that usually you would expect to hear bands play. We would do, you know, things that were a little bit different, but... I actually have a copy of an original Dudley and the Do-Rights handwritten song list from 1965 when we played for a couple of high school graduation parties, and I just made copies of that and shared that with all the guys in the band that are still alive. Our friend Dan Munson passed away about 6 years ago.
So how did the 45 come about, UFO and Mystery Train?
Well, Mystery Train was one of those bluesy kind of songs that we played in our normal itinerary, but Jim Donna, ambitious record promoter, booking agent that he was, had collaborated on a couple of songs, and he felt that it would be pretty easy for us to get a contract or at least get something placed with their label, with Soma. And so he co-wrote with a couple other guys, guy by the name of Len Bakke, I think was the guy's name, and another guy, Crydell. They wrote another novelty song kind of in the Liar Liar genre, but it was just when all the UFO flaps started, you know, the swamp gas and all these sightings that seemed to just come up out of nowhere. And so it was like, you know, just jump on the bandwagon as something that was a little public phenomena.
There was a large number of reported UFO sightings
exactly.
At this time period.
Yep. And so we thought, well, let's ride the bandwagon. And the band guys in the band absolutely just hated it. But I was thinking more commercially. You know, this was a very silly, kind of offbeat commentary, kind of a Liar Liar and one-of-a-kind novelty song. But Amos Heilacher, the guy with Soma Records, liked the song and thought it had some of that Liar Liar potential, so we went in the recording studio and recorded it and put Mystery Train on the other side. And I think there's probably some of the most legendary worst diatonic chromatic harmonica work that I played on that song.
What studio was that recorded at?
That was at K-Bank, the old Vern Bank Studios down on 27th and Hennepin, where Liar Liar and a lot of those other things were recorded.
So what year did this 45 come out on the Soma label?
That would have been 1965.
Anything happened with the record?
Actually, there were some sales and there was some radio play, but we never really ended up going any further than Wisconsin or North and South Dakota out of the region. To actually back up the record. I just don't think that it probably got the kind of push that it needed.
So what happens next with Dudley and the Do-Rights after the record comes out?
Well, one afternoon, I got a phone call from Jim Donna, and Jim Donna said, would you be interested in joining the Castaways with your guitar player? And I said, well, I have no idea what to even think about that. And he said, well, our guitar player is getting drafted. And he said, I want to go finish my engineering degree our bass player and drummer suggested that you and your guitar player be the replacements. So I had to call Tom Houston and ask him what he thought. We were both having a real hard time because of our loyalty to these guys that we'd played with through almost our entire high school career.
Who was in the lineup in the Castaways at this point?
Roy Hensley on bass and Bob Fauchon on guitar, and Denny Croswell on drums and Jim Dunn on keyboard.
So what was your decision?
It was hard, but knowing how much we respected the band and the guys that were still the mainstays in the band, we thought it was probably a great career move. And it was hard to break the news to the other guys in the band, but it was a decision that Footy, Tom, and I made, and it was, we were pretty excited about it.
So you and Tom both joined the Castaways.
And coincidentally, at the same time, the two original members, Denny Croswell and Roy Hensley, had convinced Greg Malin from Gregory D and the Avadis to join at the same time, so we'd have a five-piece band.
The preceding interview was recorded on February 5th, 2010, at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota, and was produced by Danny Johnson and Tom Campbell. The copyright owner of this interview is MiniPaulMusic.com.